Hi, I'm Kathy Forstey, music director at Casey Cafe Radio. Today I have the pleasure of chatting with the eclectic duo of Ravis Cole, Lori Ravis and Dennis Cole. Their new album, Electric Blue Dandelion, is climbing the charts and receiving rave reviews. Lori's strong and clear vocals combined with Dennis's fingerstyle picking make this album not only a musically accomplished album, but the songs cannot be defined by one genre. Pop, rock, blues, and Americana are just a few of the styles heard on Electric Blue Dandelion. Thanks, Ravis Cole, for joining us today on Casey Cafe Radio.
Well, thank you, Kathy. It's our pleasure to talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you, Kathy.
I just wanted to know right off the bat, how did you guys meet and how did Ravis Cole come to be?
Oh, yeah, this is a good one.
Well, Lori was living in Boston and I was living in Bellingham, Washington, and we met in the middle in the Crown of the Continent Guitar Festival, which is an annual guitar festival and teaching opportunity in Big Fork, Montana. So we didn't know each other before Montana, but that's where we met.
Well, do you want to tell more? We'll tell you a little bit more. We were actually in a jam class together. So we were both on electric guitars, learning different blues and jazz things in this classroom. And Dennis was in the classroom, and I thought he had this little amp, but it was so loud. It was called a lunchbox, and I had never seen one before. And I thought, who is that guy with that loud amp over there? So he kind of got my attention. But afterwards in class, what started happening is I would stay after, and so would Dennis, and we just started playing together. So he'd be on the guitar and I would just go over to the drums and kind of play a beat and we'd play and then we'd switch. So that's kind of how it started.
Mm-hmm.
The clincher was when Dennis said, "Can I carry your guitar, you know, after class back to the, you know, quote unquote dorms?" So
being a gentleman got him a lot of long way there.
Yeah, I got some cred.
So what did you see in the other person's style or hear in the other person's style that made you want to work with them or make music with them?
Well, at my end, it is not just the style itself musically, but it's the person. And Lori is a very inventive, creative, spontaneous person. And she exudes good humor and playfulness, and that shows up in her music as well. So I think in part, such as Lori referenced playing together and, you know, spontaneously, the willingness to take a leap and to try different things, such as playing the drums, etc., is a hallmark of her style as a person and her style as a musician. So that was very attractive to me.
What were you guys doing before you met up? Were you both musicians? Were you working solo? Were you working with bands?
Well, at that time, for me, I was a partner in a law firm. And so my full-time day job was as a trial lawyer. And my personal interest in creative self-expression was as a musician. And I was beginning to look forward to the time when I would make a decision to walk away from being an active practicing attorney and become a full-time musician.
And I was in Boston. I was teaching at Emerson College. I was teaching marketing. And prior to that, I had been working in marketing at various companies. And along the way, had always had music and was playing music, but was never able to, or actually didn't, how do I phrase that correctly? I didn't consider it to be a full-time endeavor. I didn't think that it would possibly ever become a full-time endeavor, but I loved it and I was very passionate about it. And I think the turning point for me was at some point I decided that I want to get more into what it is that I'm actually supposed to be doing in this life of mine, what's closer to my heart. And I went through an exploration process and I tried various things like stand-up comedy and improv comedy and acting and music. And I decided music was really what's been there all along. And I wanted to just really focus on it and become a better musician. What I didn't understand was that along the process, it would take hold of me and I would actually become more and more involved in music to the point where I was playing in bands in Boston. I was in an all-girl band and I was in a couple other bands playing the electric guitar and then meanwhile always playing the acoustic guitar. And in one of those bands, they needed a singer. So that's how I started singing because, you know, one of the bands needed a singer. And there was something in me that wanted to do it. And I found myself starting to write songs. And it just occurred to me that my whole life I had been writing poetry, which was essentially a form of lyrics that I really wasn't aware of. So it was a whole process for me that evolved to bring me to where I am today. And that started very seriously probably a decade ago, but I always played, you know, up until that point. I think I picked up the guitar, my mom's old Gibson, probably when I was 16, 17. So I went through the process of, you know, learning all the chords, that painful process. So at least I had that under my fingertips before I really started 10 years ago practicing. Gosh, I was practicing like 3 hours a day because I was so into it.
Wow. So yeah. You mentioned your mom had a Gibson guitar. Did you come from a musical family?
I got to say, no. Mm-hmm. I think not really. You know, I came from a long line of teachers. And my mom would play the guitar, but she would actually, she'd play at parties, but she would go sit in the garage with her, you know, face facing away from the audience or away from the people at the party when we were barbecuing, because she was really shy. But she had notebooks of songs, and she had written songs, and she had played a bunch of songs, but she was super shy. You know, so that was about it. And I know there was a fiddle player in our family and the, you know, the grandparent generation and great grandparent generations.
Was this all in the Boston area?
I grew up in Connecticut, so okay. Mostly Connecticut. Then I moved to Boston afterwards for school.
How about you, Dennis? Do you come from a musical family?
No, not really. My paternal grandparents, well, my maternal grandmother was liked to sing, and I have an aunt who played the accordion. I don't have siblings. Neither my father nor my mother played music. So music was really my own thing. And I was first introduced to music, I believe when I was 6 years old, maybe it was 8 years old. In school, they gave us a piece of cardboard with a keyboard printed out on it. And so that was my first music experience, was learning how to play a piece of cardboard.
Yeah.
But that segued into, I wanted a guitar. My mother decided I should have a violin. So I started off learning how to play the violin, and I always wanted to play the guitar. Mm-hmm. So when I was 14, I made a little bit of money, and I took my $50 and I bought an Aria 551B, a classical guitar, and started playing guitar.
What kind of music were you playing then? Were you making up your own stuff, or were you playing stuff on the radio, or what were you doing?
Well, initially I was playing classical music, and I had an interest in flamenco, but I was playing classical music. But then, you know, as you learn the chords and things like that, I started to make up my own music, my own songs. But I was always a closet performer, wouldn't perform for other people. And I dabbled along when music, guitar remained a steady and consistent interest for me for a long, long time. And I picked up the ability to, you know, work my way around on a piano and that type of thing. But then finally, I would say maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago, I was really looking forward and thinking, what is it that's going to keep me really connected with people, interested in life, creative, playful, etc., particularly if I'm not going to work and being a lawyer every day? Where's my joy?
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be sports. But then, like many older athletes, you say, well, I really can't do that anymore, but I can still play the guitar. And I could see that playing music was one of those things that would offer really a lifetime worth of possibility, intellectual stimulation, creative satisfaction, you know, just the pleasure of learning so many new and different things. And then became much more serious for me when Lori and I discovered each other and began to have the experience of playing together, creating together, to find your soulmate and also your performance partner in the same person. It's a wonderful stroke of luck.
So how about you, Lori? Did you have a musical family? And I mean, was it any musical influences back in those days that kind of got you to where you are today?
You know, I did take piano lessons, which I think helped, you know, and I did that at a younger age. But my focus drifted pretty quickly off into sports, and I was also into horseback riding. So I had a pony, which I just adored. And so I spent a lot of time just, you know, being around my pony and being around horses and so forth. I just loved animals and sports. So music took a back seat at that point in time. But as I, you know, grew up a little bit in the, you know, teenage years. The music meant so much to me as far as trying to help me understand my own feelings of maturing and growing up. And I was an avid concert goer and an avid music listener. I had so many albums, and that was one pleasure that I always look forward to, was just simply putting a record on the turntable and looking at the album and reading the liner notes and just, you know, sort of getting lost in it.
Yeah.
So it was just, I mean, I really treasure those times. And I was a crazy tape maker. You know, I just used to love making mixtapes.
Yeah. I really miss those days where you could sit down and grab all your albums or your 45s and just sit down and make a mixtape. I mean, that was just so much fun. I always like came up with different themes. I was doing it. Like, I'd make like a theme about songs about the rain or something like that, you know, tapes about that. And so, yeah, I miss the old mixtape days.
Yeah, and it was so tactile. I mean, I know, you know, we've made a few mixes on Spotify, but it, you know, I like the tactileness of being able to touch stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the digital world is, it's wonderful because you have access to everything, but there's always, you know, two sides. And so I do miss more of the touchy feely tactileness of it.
Yeah, I'm still, I could count on one hand the number of songs I've downloaded for myself personally. I mean, I download all the time for Casey Cafe Radio, but I'm not a download person for my own personal listening, you know. I still like buying CDs and LPs and stuff, so.
Well, we do too. And I feel like, you know, when you drive around the car, there's nothing more satisfying than being able to listen to a whole album.
Mm, yes.
Yeah. Just so you understand the artist more, as opposed to, I know music started out as singles and then moved into the world of albums and concepts.
I'll interject that, well, yeah, I agree that one of the real pleasures of the older formats, where it's not easy to shift from song to song, it's not easy to, you know, like with an LP, to get up and replay a song and reposition the stylus, etc., you know, that it ended up that you would listen to longer stretches of music from the same artist. And I think very frequently the song that was the song that would initially attract me to a particular artist or a particular album didn't end up being my favorite song.
Right.
The ones that, because I was listening to the whole thing, I had the opportunity to really pay attention to and appreciate secondary tracks. And that is something that I think is harder to do with streaming, because with streaming, the accessibility is wonderful. You know, you can jump from person to person to person to person to person, or song to song to song to song, but it typically becomes where you listen to 15 or 20 seconds sometime, and it's next, 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 and you never really sit, or you're unlikely to really sit and listen and appreciate the work as a whole. And so you have a lot more variety, but a loss of depth. And
right.
I like listening to somebody's, you know, like an album, and listen to the whole album. And that to me is more satisfying.
Yeah. And some songs take a while to grow on you too, you know? And so it takes a few listens to really get it and appreciate it, and maybe even get what they're actually saying in the song, or to take away something that you never, you know, you never got before.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a lot of the power in listening to deeper cuts and albums as well. I know as a teacher, I have students who come in and say, I want to learn this song. And I'm like, who does it? And they go, I don't know. You know, I'm just like, how can you not know? How can you not want to know about this artist that wrote this song and why they wrote this song? And, you know, those are the kind of things that always intrigued me.
It's also one of the powers that you have when you curate a collection of music, like on the radio, you know, the ability to put things together that the listener would not necessarily put together for themselves, because they're not aware of it, because things don't hit them in the same way, etc. When you listen to what other people hear in music and the connections they make, it expands your own thinking and your own sense of connection with the music and how it relates to other things.
Right. We talked about influences. So what albums were you listening to? What songs were you making these mixtapes of?
You know, it's funny. There's so much great music, in my opinion, for so many different times in your life, for so many different moods, for so many different feelings. But I got to tell you, at that time, one of my favorite was Michael Jackson, Off the Wall. Mm-hmm. There was Pink Floyd's The Wall, you know, so it's like it was a lot of, if you will, feet and, you know, booty music. And then there was heart and mind music. So it was usually a mix depending upon if I felt like, you know, I wanted to kind of lift my spirits, get fired up about something, or if I was in more of a reflective kind of mood. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't at that age have been able to describe the fact I was in a reflective kind of processing mood. But now I realize that that's what that was looking back.
Yeah. What a boring world it would be if we just listened to one style of music all the time, right? So.
Yeah, because I mean, think about us. I mean, hopefully I'm evolving. Hopefully, you know, I'm trying to become the best person I can, as cheesy as that may sound. But I make an effort and I take actions to do so. And the music can reflect, you know, where you are at different points of just even in the day, mm-hmm. you know, and just... Yeah, we're just not the same all the time.
Well, and music is also not simply a verbal expression, you know, or an intellectual exercise. And I think the fundamental power of music arises more from its ability to express emotion and to stimulate mm-hmm. emotion. And we're not in the same emotional state all the time. So sometimes you could be having a sad and blue kind of day. You could be having a cheerful, up-tempo kind of day. You could be having a sleepy kind of relaxed moment. You should say, well, I got to go work out, but I really don't want to. But mm-hmm. gosh, it's something to get my energy level up.
Right.
You know? You don't want to listen to the same thing all the time for one reason, because your emotional mood varies enough where it demands a different thing to both stimulate and to express how you're feeling emotionally.
And so at what point did you take that and put it into your own music and writing songs?
For myself, I would say that my early songs were primitive. Yeah, I've got three chords and I'm not afraid to use them. And by God, one of them's a minor. And, you know, it tended to relate to sort of, you know, primitive teenage singer-songwriter things mostly. Oh, there's a cute girl in the world and I wish she noticed me. You know, not all that way, but quite a bit. But I would say generally in my earlier time writing, I tended to write more when I was feeling either somewhat down or somewhat stressed about something or another. It would be kind of some kind of an emotional catharsis. And I think, you know, a lot of great music comes from a place of pain. Mm-hmm. And that when you're, you know, that there's not that many Don't Worry, Be Happy songs in the world.
I'm betting that song came from a place of pain too.
Well, and, you know, and I think that in... more recently, when it goes from saying, okay, I want to express something or another that I'm thinking about at the moment, I even bother to write it down. When you start to create songs that are, one, collaborations, and two, songs that look to be, have greater aspirations than just telling the world something about, telling yourself something about how you yourself feel, you know, then the themes change. I think that if you write a song, you know, you can write a song for yourself, and there's no problem with writing a song for yourself. It's a perfectly valid thing to do. But if you are writing a song in which you want to communicate emotion, you want other people to be able to relate to the song that you write and to import their own meaning to the lyrics that you offer them, etc., you have to go and get beyond yourself. And I think that, you know, that's a more mature version of songwriting and really a more interesting version of songwriting.
Have you ever liked had someone request to write a song for them and written a song for someone?
I have had a request to write a song for someone. There's performing artists who ask us to do that. We are thinking about it. We haven't done it yet. So far, the songs we've written have been for, I mean, the songs we've written formally have been for ourselves.
It was a neat idea. I mean, this happened just recently when we were in Florida to consider somebody likes our style, our music, the way we're conveying things enough to say, gosh, would you consider writing a song for me? I'm not exactly like how you both present yourselves as a duo, Ravis Cole. However, I feel confident enough to say that I think you could represent me, and I'm more of a balladeer. I'm more of a romantic at heart. So it's in the works.
But the power of writing for some, not just writing for yourself, was illustrated with one day we were performing one of our songs, Holding On to a Rainbow. And for ourselves, that song was the first song that we wrote together. And in many respects, it arose out of the fact that we were in the process of falling in love and the feelings that were coming up in response to that. And we performed that song, and I'll let Lori tell the rest of the story, but a woman who was listening to it was very touched by it and came to talk to Lori about her reaction to that. And it was really profoundly meaningful and profoundly satisfying. Lori, can you tell the rest of that?
We were at a festival up in Birch Bay, which is, you know, very close to home here in Bellingham, Washington. And we performed our set, and afterwards I talked to this person, and she just had this look about her where I knew there was something inside her, and she wanted to talk to me, but we didn't really say anything deep to each other. We're very cordial, and she bought a CD. But a month or so later, I got an email from her, which actually was just very, it was just unbelievable. I mean, it was very uplifting. She said that on the way to the show, her husband, who she was with, had been diagnosed with a brain disease. And, you know, his personality was changing. He was having memory loss. And he was essentially going to be disappearing in front of her and going to be dying in the next couple of years. So this was her soulmate of 30 years, and she was really struggling to process all this information and what to do with it. And she said the song, Holding On to a Rainbow, helped put her feelings into words. It really helped for her to feel connected in a way, and also helped her to clarify and process part of these overwhelming emotions. And we've kept in touch, and her husband has passed away, but, you know, it was such a gift. She said the song was a gift for her to hear, but for us, it's a gift to be able to connect with somebody on that level and help them through such a time in their life.
Yeah.
You know, that's not how we wrote the song, but it's okay. You know, we write the song and we put it out into the world, and then it's really, in my opinion, not really my song or our song anymore. It's for people to take and utilize, you know, to help them in their own lives.
Right. Yeah. It's the power of music and the power of art. People can mm-hmm. take it and interpret it into their own lives. It's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Electric Blue Dandelion. Tell me, first of all, what is an Electric Blue Dandelion? And how did that become the title track?
Well, it became the title track because it's one of the songs, Electric Blue Dandelion. But that's, gosh, it was something that I had written down. My mother has passed away 11 years ago, and probably 5 years after she passed, I was able to start writing the song about what that was like for me to lose her. And, you know, I'm always writing. I'm always journaling. And at some point, I had realized that I had written already, maybe a couple of years after she passed, this phrase, Electric Blue Dandelion, and I had written more around it. And I actually didn't know what it meant at the time that I wrote it down. But if you just look at Electric Blue Dandelion, what that meant to me for that song was a dandelion, you know, it's essentially a weed, and they grow everywhere. And for me, my mother, you know, in losing her, I realized she was like a dandelion for me. She was integrated into my whole soul, my whole being, you know, characteristics of her, etc. And in losing somebody, it was very helpful to realize she's still a part of me. The electric blue part of the dandelion was her uniqueness, you know, her sparkle, and then the ability for the electric blue to kind of sparkle off as somebody passes. The transformation that you have to go through of letting go of somebody you love who passes and kind of dispersing that energy in a different way than when somebody is physically here.
Well, and you know, that wasn't my song, but when you look at, but I love it. And when you look at a dandelion as, you know, it goes from its yellow state to the wispy little feathery seeds that blow off in the puff of wind and disperse to start the next cycle of dandelions is kind of the, you know, Laurie has a line in there, energy me to you. And, you know, we could kind of go Walt Disney and the circle of life and that type of thing, you know, but it really is the circle of life. The fact that the people we love, people who are meaningful in our lives, continue to have a presence in the world, even after they pass, based upon our memories of them, our feelings about them, how they have influenced us, how they have influenced other people. And, you know, someday the same will be true for us. We will continue to have a presence in the world after we pass, based upon that same thing. And I think at the end of the day, that song has some very powerful description of some of the feelings of loss and facing the loss and going through the loss. But it has a very healing resolution at the end in terms of that transfer of energy me to you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really, you know, when you're just talking about it, I was just imagining, you know, the dandelion that becomes the little puffy thing, and then those blow off and they seed other things, you know, and so that spirit carries on after they're gone even, you know, so.
And Kathy, I know you can appreciate this as a songwriter yourself, but me having written that phrase down and not really understanding it until, honestly, after the song is written, done, recorded, and I started to reflect even more on it, I'm like, wow, mm-hmm. I'm learning even from my own song. Like, I wasn't even understanding the how meaningful that phrase was to me until later.
Yeah. Songwriting is just such a powerful thing. I mean, it's a subconscious thing that comes through that you just, sometimes you don't realize it for years, what it is that you actually wrote, you know? It's like, oh, okay, now I know what I was saying.
Yeah.
Well, and I think in other contexts, the exercise of going through and trying to put your thoughts and feelings into words is a wonderful exercise in many different contexts for a lot of different reasons. But within this context, to have to describe to yourself, describe to somebody else, an emotional state is something that is involved in that songwriting process. And I think that the more you do it, the better you get at it. But the more you do it, also the more aware you are yourself of what you are thinking and feeling, because you've taken the time to look at it. You've taken the time to try to assign words at it, to try to be to it, to try to explain it to someone else. So yeah, there's a lot of self-growth that can come out of the songwriting process.
Right. Yeah. Another song, I mean, just to kind of switch gears on song styles, maybe, I don't know, maybe you'll tell me a story about this song that I'll be surprised about. But the song Aloha is a song that we've had a lot of people requesting on the station and really love a lot. Tell me about that song.
Well, that's, Aloha is a motel here in Bellingham, Washington. There's three motels that are very close together, Aloha, Max, the Villa Inn. And they were in the newspapers, you know, week after week after week, a year or so, maybe a couple of years ago. And it was essentially a place where people would go to do methamphetamines. And they were having a real issue with that. And it was closing down. And there was, you know, orange signs that the hotel rooms themselves were condemned. And it was just this triangle of, you know, it was like what I say, a devil's triangle that demons were dancing within. So I was captivated by this, and I would drive by in the car and I would just observe and I would just watch. And, you know, lo and behold, they did actually bulldoze the Aloha down. But in that time frame, when I would drive by and I would watch, and it conjured up different stories. And the thing about the Aloha that was difficult for me, and, you know, as a songwriter, you have to make choices, was there was this part of that hotel that was really struggling with drug addiction, really struggling with people overdosing, really struggling with attracting that for those three hotels. But there was also another side where people with families who were working and trying to make ends meet were also living there. So at that point, I made the choice to focus on the other end. But there, you know, as a lot of things in life, there's different pockets that make the whole.
Mm-hmm. Part of the vividness of aloha. You know, aloha is the Hawaiian word for both greeting and goodbye. And, you know, the hotel itself had this old kind of 50s-style cheesy sign with a palm tree on it, et cetera. But then, you know, you think about that and you go, you know, as we talk about it, the Aloha Motel, you know, the place where dreams go to die, where people go to die in a way that, you know, they start down the... methamphetamine is really a terrible drug. And the people who are caught up in the web of addiction... it's very depressing and it's very kind of a hopeless type of thing. And to think about people who in a way are checking out of life, mm-hmm. you know, and that became the, you know, sort of the undercurrent of that song. And Lori at that time was studying some altered tuning. So she wrote the song in an altered tuning, which I thought suited the song brilliantly well. And then to put the music to that, I think we tried to do a T-Bone Burnett kind of style thing that's sort of just kind of stripped down and raw because the storyline of the song is raw. Anyway, it's a real interesting process.
Does the lyrics drive what style you decide to write a song in or arrange a song in?
Well, I mean, I think it does for everybody. You know, you're not going, if you pick minor keys and things like that, you're more likely to have, at least in our Western tradition, it's, you know, it tends to drive things compared to major keys, et cetera. But everybody does their own thing. I think that you know, if you looked at somebody and they were cursing a blue streak, but they were smiling, you know, you would say, well, something seems incongruent about the message that I'm getting. You know, the emotional affect that I'm seeing is inconsistent with the words that I'm hearing. When you listen to a song, you want to try to find the key, the type of harmony, the type of melody that expresses the mood that you're trying to create. So like with Electric Blue Dandelion, I mean, we had some major and minor sorts of chord transitions in there to kind of capture the mood. With Aloha, I think that the key, the alter tuning that Lori used really kind of captured that powerful, somewhat dark quality that's in that song.
So do you try to write songs that incorporate different genres then?
It happens naturally.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it evolves. Like, you know, one of the beauties of being interested in a lot of music is that you have access to your toolkit and you can say, oh, I know a clave rhythm, or I know a, you know, what reggae sounds like. I know an Americana. So if that style suits what you're trying to convey, I mean, for me, it's usually there's an overall concept or an overall idea, an overall theme for the song, and that starts to come out in parts. It never comes out whole. I mean, I've heard about people who, you know, I don't know if it really happens this way, but they sit down and they just write a song, you know, and it's like, I started here and I finished here and that was it. For me, it's more pieces of a song and there's this idea. So the pieces come out within the lyrics, the ideas start to come, and then I essentially create a storyboard in my head, and the storyboard will then dictate, you know, because there's different scenes in a storyboard, so the storyboard dictates what kind of genre, you know, and it doesn't have to be the same genre in every scene, per se, of the overall story. But most of the times it seems like there's maybe two different feels or two different styles within the music. You know, I've been known to do three or four. So it just depends on, you know, as long as I feel like the concept and the overall idea is getting conveyed and communicated appropriately, it's the coolest thing to be able to take the lyrics and then overlay the different melody that scene deserves and the different harmony and the different rhythmic, because they all help to drive and convey, communicate that message. I mean, like Dennis was saying, you know, if you're singing a sad song, you're more likely to do a minor key, but perhaps you would do a major key to sad lyrics because you want them to get inside the listener in a way that they wouldn't if the listener knows, oh, this is supposed to be super sad. It just depends on what the idea. He's smiling.
Well, I mean, Lori has more of a storyboard, and for my own process is I tend to assemble things that kind of like a chef might go shopping, you know, and you have different spices and different ingredients, and they're laying around somewhere if I don't forget them. And then when something starts to come together, I look in my little cupboard and I start to see, well, what do I have, you know, that maybe fits with this, and start blending things together and see what I come up with. But fundamentally, I think music is in so many other areas, you know, there people love a certain degree of order, and people love a certain degree of chaos. Everything that is all predictable, it's comforting in a way, but it also gets kind of boring. And things that are surprising, things that are new, things that are novel are stimulating, but too much of that gets exhausting. Sometimes I find that with real hardcore jazz, you know, that I like it, I'll listen to it, but after 5 minutes I'm exhausted because I can't identify enough of the patterns that it really makes a lot of sense to me. So when I think about music, or, you know, I tend to think about, well, I want to keep enough predictability in what I'm doing that people can recognize patterns, that it sort of makes sense, kind of like with a joke. You know, you recognize now here's the tension, okay, and now here's the punchline and here's the release. It keeps your interest, but I don't want to go so far in the direction that it starts just to seem random, and I don't want to go so far in the direction that it's so predictable that it's just like, okay, well, I heard the first 20 seconds or 30 seconds of your song and now I know there everything there is to know about it.
So do you start off usually with a title, or do you come up with an idea for what you want to, like an emotion you want to write about, or how does the idea for a song germinate?
It really varies. Like Holding On to a Rainbow arose out of wordplay. We were on different coasts at the time, and I think I had taken a bike ride, and it was kind of a rainy day out here, and I was riding on the bike, and you have a certain amount of rhythm in terms of your pedaling cadence. And I thought about a rainbow, and then I thought about holding on to a rainbow, and then I thought about, you know, what that kind of meant. And when I started communicating around that idea, and that grew into the song of Holding On to a Rainbow. You know, it can be a rhythmic line like a Wicked Game. We didn't write Wicked Game, but we tried to make Wicked Game our own. And Wicked Game started off with, I was into polyrhythms at that time and trying to play with the idea of polyrhythms and then transitioning into a Latin clave rhythm. And that really sort of became what influenced the song into the direction that it ultimately went, with a real sort of Latin reggaeton sort of rhythm to it. And I know Lori is a very, very visual person, and she tends to think in very vivid visual terms. And so I think that, you know, for her, she can speak for herself around it. But I mean, our process is a little different in terms of where we come from. I think she might tend to start with a more visual oriented idea or more of a storyboard idea first than, but anyway, I mean, she'll tell you the truth. I'm guessing.
I was just shaking my head a little bit. I said, no, kind of. Yeah, sometimes. It's really, it's a feeling, or if it's something that I have to wrap my head around, and it's usually something I'm not really, it sounds so funny. It sounds so mysterious and gray and messy and muddy, but this is how it is for me. I write a lot, and then I noodle around on the guitar. Like, I just play around a lot. I study different rhythms. So I'm in a phase now where I know I'm going to start writing a lot of songs. I've been playing around the guitar, and there's a few melodic lines and a few different chord progressions and new and interesting sounds. And I'm like, gosh, I really like those. I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet. And then I write, and certain phrases catch me. And it's like, I need to write about that. For whatever reason, it comes from deep within. And I feel like I need to say something about that. I'm not exactly sure why, but there's something very internal and that motivates me, that drives me to have to write the song. And then I start to match up, what rhythms does that warrant? What different melodies, what different harmonies? And Dennis and I can do this kind of exploration together. The other day you got out, what was that new bass guitar?
Yeah, I have a wonderful fretless acoustic bass. I've started to experiment with that, and the sounds that come out of that are kind of reminiscent of the Jaco Pastorius sound, particularly when he played with Joni Mitchell. But I find that different instruments really bring out different things. You know, I think that the act of creating music is for me, influenced heavily by whatever instrument I have. So if I'm creating a song on a piano, it sounds different than a song that I create on a guitar. This morning before you called, I was playing with a baritone guitar and a partial capo and an altered tuning.
Upside down.
No. Underwater.
Underwater. Snorkel.
Well, you approach, you know, instead of a top-down approach where you say, I'm having a theory about what I should be doing on this, it really encourages a bottom-up approach where you listen and you go, oh, what do I like? What is the ring of the open strings against, you know, where I'm putting my fingers on these things? And, you know, and because the structure of the instrument, like the structure of the guitar, you know, there's certain types of things. A lot of movement is in a step, a half step, a step, a step and a half. So, you know, you keep one finger in the same place or move it down half a step, and you move your other fingers around to some sort of patterns that look familiar. And out of that, you know, you start to play and you start to get a sense of where the sweetness is. You know, where's the diatonic harmony? Where are the things that are coming out of this? And it's really fun because it forces you to listen. You know, you're not just going to your old bag of chords that you know and say, okay, well, I'm going to put a suspended chord here, or I'm going to do this there. And instead, you're really listening to what you're playing and you go, what sounds nice? Well, what would sound next to that? And what would sound, you know, and then you start putting it together and it starts to emerge in a way which is both playful and different. Because you didn't just go into your toolbox and got out the same old tools you always use. And instead, you know, you went to the hardware store and you bought a grab bag.
Yeah, it forces creativity. Yeah,
well, I wouldn't say it forces, it stimulates creativity.
Yeah, that's maybe a better way to say it.
So the idea of coming up with a song title, I've taken songwriting classes that say you need a song title and it should be in your chorus or it should be in your refrain. And I know other people who write a song, they have the discipline of writing a song. I think people have written a song a day. And that hasn't been my experience. Maybe someday I'll try that, but I haven't been able to be that exact about it. As you're probably getting a sense, Dennis and I we're okay with being a little messy about the process. I actually find it just to be cool because you don't know where it's going to go exactly. And I think the thing is you just have to trust. I remember reading, I think it was in Neil Young's book, you know, him, he was worried about drying up, essentially not being able to write a song. And it's just, you know, you have to just trust that it'll come, it'll be there. I mean, I think there's things you can stimulate yourself and do other activities or learn another instrument to stimulate the process. But I haven't been the person who comes up with the song title or written a song a day yet, I suppose. I'm open.
Yeah. I wish I was one of those people too. I wish I could write a song a day, but there's some years of my life where I'm just happy that I wrote a song that year, you know?
Yeah, it's also really, at times it can be aggravating to have to make compromises and say, if I'm caught up in an idea, like, wait, I don't want to hear some other idea. No, wait, I don't want to change this. I love this idea. But, you know, truth be told, I think there is a lot of benefit to playing together and to creating together because it helps you think about things that you would not ordinarily think about on your own or to see things in a different way or put things together in a different way. And that is that's a beautiful part of the process. All grumbling aside from time to time, it's a beautiful part of the process. And I think that I look at Electric Blue Dandelion and the way we work together in terms of creating that album, and it's very satisfying. Electric Blue Dandelion, that's Laurie's song. I didn't write that song. Laurie wrote that song. You know, I helped put some of the music together to it, but it's her song. But I love that song, you know, and to be part of being able to take something like that and be able to make it your own. You know, not really your own, but to where you have some ownership of it and the identification with it. But the creativity that I said earlier, Laurie's very creative. If you look at a song like Precipice, where you're kind of going everything from Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young to George Harrison and Ravi Shankar, you name it, to things like Aloha, to things like Electric Blue Dandelion, to things from Laurie's first album, 101, to a beautiful song. It Must Be Okay. I mean, it sounds like Carole King. It's just a beautiful, beautifully arranged, beautifully polished song, but it's certainly not something that is written, you know, in the song of day, hook-based formula. You know, you can approach music as a business, and you can approach songwriting as a business, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when you, from our perspective, where we are trying to be creative artists, we're not trying to produce songs for everybody. We're trying to produce the best songs that we know how to write or that we're capable of writing at the time that are authentic and that are meaningful. You know, they're very self-expressive, and hopefully they are also accessible to other people to where they feel that they can make that song their own, that they can find their own meaning in that song, you know, that we've been successful in stimulating the creation of emotion and connection with other people.
Yeah. So how do you take your ideas for these arrangements and take them to the studio and create this? Is it all done beforehand, or is it something that happens in the studio? How do you put these songs together once you get in there? Because you got such a variety of styles going on.
Well, we worked with Matt Smith, who has been a mentor for us. He's a wonderful musician, wonderful singer, wonderful producer, and wonderful human being. You know, we had some pre-production meetings with Matt where we would play what we had for him and have some feedback. But, you know, essentially, the songs on Electric Blue Dandelion came into the studio with their genesis being Lori and I, our primary instruments are both guitar players. So the songs were the skeleton of the songs. The way they're structured came out of our play together. The recording and mastering in the studio, I mean, Matt used his vision to help in terms of adding some different types of instruments. For example, one was a T-play, a South American kind of ukulele, a hammer tone guitar, which was a high-strung octave guitar, a high-strung Nashville tuning guitar, other kinds of things where you say, you know, okay, well, what kind of instruments color the sound of what you have in there? But one of the things that we are still able to do with all the songs from Electric Blue Dandelion is to take those songs out and perform them as a duo with guitars and still have that recognizably be the song that was created in the studio, because at heart, that's, you know, those are our songs, it's our vision, our structure, and it was preserved throughout the process.
Yeah, I mean, literally in the studio, I play the acoustic guitar just like I would when we go out and perform. We sing just like we would when we go out and perform, and Dennis is able to play his guitar parts. The cool part of the studio is that you can then layer on the quote-unquote sensuous textures that add and enhance the song. So we're able to play all the different cool instruments to just, you know, really communicate what we're trying to say.
Well, and sometimes it's also a challenge. I remember particularly in Wicked Game sitting in the studio, and all of a sudden we made kind of a change from our live version, which is really sort of clave based, into a mento beat, which is a Jamaican beat pre-ska. And Matt handed me a T-play, which has 10 strings on it, in a course of two, a course of three, a course of three, and a course of two. And it's like, here, play this.
It's like a Colombian ukulele, right?
Well, old Martin, but it's like a South American ukulele. But if you crossed a ukulele with a 12 string, you might get that. And, you know, under the gun in the studio being recorded to go pick up some instrument you haven't played before and to play it is a challenge. And, you know, when you pull it, fortunately, you can have more than one take, but it's interesting. It's fun. And, you know, it's part of the to allow other input from other people, such as a producer who hears something different in the songs than you hear too. Right. To allow that and be open to, accepting input and ideas for how to more fully flesh out what you brought into the studio is really a joy.
Yeah, it takes the right producer to work with too, I think, to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt fortunately was my teacher prior to me meeting Dennis, and it was Dennis's teacher prior to, you know, us meeting. So We've known him for quite a long time. I didn't quite say that smoothly.
Yeah, he had nothing to do with us. Well, actually, he really did, because if it wasn't for Matt, I probably would never have been in Montana.
Okay.
Matt was in Montana.
Okay, so there we go.
So how do you take these songs then out on the road? Do you have like a backseat just full of guitars and stuff? Is it just two guitars you take on the road? What's your setup when you're out on the road?
Well, we try to bring two guitars each so that when you go into the alternate tunings, it's just easier. But that's not really the easiest way to travel. So
when you're traveling by airplane, you don't do that.
Yeah, we pared it down to one guitar each, and we just, you know, we do what we have to do, and we try to create the set list so that it's the most efficient. You know, so that if you're going to an open D tuning, we first go to drop D, then we go to double drop D, then we, you know, go to open, you know, that kind of thing. Because it just is the most efficient. It's hard to carry that many guitars around.
Yeah, but like part of the arrangement, I mean, part of the things that one of the challenges in us both being guitar players is to differentiate the sonic spectrum so that we're not just sitting on top of each other in the sound mix. One of the ways that we do that is there are times, because Lori's usually carrying the rhythm, that I will play in a different tuning than she is playing in, something that emphasizes the bass and makes the bass easier to play. So there are times when I'm playing where I'm trying to pretend like I'm a bass, or I may be in the same song at other times trying to pretend I'm a mandolin. We recorded a video up in Blue Frog Studios in White Rock, which is just across the border up in Canada. And they have a wonderful facility, and the guy who owns it and runs it is a bass player. So you go into the control room, and he's got all these basses in there. And we recorded Wicked Game. And I was talking to him afterwards. I was saying, yeah, I mean, I try to sound like a bass in this song because it's a really groove-driven
And Dennis
element.
Is playing a jazz guitar, essentially. So yeah. it's not your average bass sound.
But I'm playing a jazz guitar with big flat-wound strings. And the guy said, yeah, I mean, I heard that. And I looked, I said, where's that bass coming from? You know, well, that's what we try to do in terms of our setup on the road. You know, I use some effects that times to give more of a Pink Floyd-y type sound on certain songs, but we try to make the two of us sound as full as possible because we don't just want to sound like two guitar players playing the same thing.
You mentioned the video. How can people see that video?
If they go to YouTube, it's on YouTube. Ravis Cole, Holding Onto a Rainbow is one. I think we're Electric Blue Dandelion's going to be up there. And we have a small promo spot we shot for Wicked Game, which just actually hit the top 40 and came in at 31 on the Adult Contemporary Top 40 chart for FMQB just like 2 hours ago.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it is pretty awesome. That was our second single release, Electric Blue Dandelion being the first.
That's great. So why did you decide to do Wicked Game? What was so good about that song that you wanted to record it?
Well, the first... In part because it was the first thing that we really did together. The first song that we co-wrote was Holding On to a Rainbow. But when we were playing together and beginning to see how our different interests and styles would work together, etc., Wicked Game was, that was a song that I liked. And I mentioned earlier, at that time I was into polyrhythms. I'd be driving in the car trying to, you know, pound on the steering wheel and get a 3/4 or a 4/5 and all those kinds of things. So I had those rhythmic things on my brain, and I'd also, we had been together in a lesson, and we're talking about different types of clave rhythms, etc. And it kind of coalesced into starting that with a short polyrhythm and then going into a clave beat. And there was just something about that it was kind of fun to play. It's a fast up tempo thing, you know, particularly when you start moving into the performing direction, you want to have things that you want to vary. I said earlier, you don't want too much order, you don't want too much chaos. Well, you also don't want everything to be super fast, unless maybe you're a metal player, and you don't want to be super slow, you know? So you want to be able to engage people by having energetic, up-tempo things. And, you know, I think that part of the reason we decided to record that song is, one, we love playing it. Two, it's a great song. But a third one is that we felt proud of the version that we had created. You know, it's something that people can easily identify with because they're familiar with it. They've heard the song before. It's a classic song, you know, and it's a way of saying who we are, that we try to do things in our own way and we try to do things in a creative way. So we thought, well, we'll have one cover on the album because it's a really immediately accessible to people. They don't have to remember what the words are. You know, they already know what the words are.
Right.
So in a way, it's that same kind of thing of, you know, comfort and predictability. I know what the words are, but the stimulation of something being different. Hey, what's that beat? That's not Chris Isaak. You know, that's a different kind of beat. What's going on there? So it was just felt like it was a good move for us. It was something that we loved to play. We were proud of the arrangement that we made of it. And it's a way of also trying to say something to the world about who we are and what we're trying to do.
Right. And what sealed the decision is we literally watched, what, hundreds of Wicked Game covers on YouTube, and we didn't find any that were anything like that. So the feedback we've gotten from different program directors is that it really is a fresh remake. It really is evocative and fun and rhythmic and up-tempo and possibly better than the original, which was like, whoa, really?
That's not our word.
Yeah, we're hopefully more humble than that. But, you know, it's nice to hear to say, gosh, you know, we were able to take something and really essentially make it our own.
Yeah, that's what a cover should be. I mean, a cover should be a person making it their own, not just copying what somebody else has done. So,
well, part of the way it evolved was when we first started to play it, I had the idea to emphasize the rhythm, I would hold an egg shaker in my hand.
Yeah, that's
while
true.
Doing that clave beat. And, you know, and I thought, and I have pretty big hands, so it wasn't hard to do. You know, you play and people be looking and going, what is that? Where's that noise coming from? And then what kind of sort of surprised me was as I did that more repetitively and did that for, you know, for people who, you know, are very experienced guitar players, I didn't hear from anybody that, oh yeah, so and so, somebody else does that. All these other people do that. It seemed like, oh, he came up with an idea that is kind of fresh. It isn't something that other people are doing. And I think that, in a way, was part of the whole thing with Wicked Game, the trying to evolve it out, going, oh, well, it's familiar, but yeah, we found something that is a fresh way of looking at it, a creative way of looking at it. It doesn't feel like it's just derivative where you're doing something that somebody else did and trying to do the second best version of what they did.
Yeah.
You're trying best version of what you do.
And the rhythm, I mean, it's one of those rhythms where I practiced a lot on the guitar and then added the singing. It was very difficult to sing, you know, more legato and the way that I wanted to sing the song and do the rhythm because, you know, I tend, you know, so that's great. I mean, that's just great learning too.
Well, that clave rhythm, yeah, too. I mean, you're singing a different rhythm really than you're playing.
Yeah, and so you have to practice.
And Lori does a great job on the vocal. She just kills it.
Yeah, so it's the patting your head, scratching your belly kind of thing to learn how to do.
Yeah, chewing gum.
So, Lori, you recently became a member of the Recording Academy, and you participated in your first Grammy selection process. What was that like? And how did you become a member of that in the first place?
It's been amazing. It's an application process that you have to go through to say, yes, I am a singer-songwriter, and yes, here's my work. And you go through a process where you get approved to become a member, a voting member of the Academy. So I was really just ecstatic that I was able to do that before the Grammys last year. And, you know, the benefit is that there's a lot of really wonderful independent artists, just like ourselves, who are out there, you know, just making music and, you know, trying to create art. And so I've learned a lot about these different people. I've been able to connect with them and, you know, share our experience of what it's like to, you know, try to, you know, book yourself, create your own music, you know, the DIY kind of approach with the indies. And so that's been wonderful, but also to get inspired by the fact that there is so much great music out there because, you know, sometimes I think it's hard to be aware of all the great music that there is out there that people are creating who, you know, otherwise you wouldn't know about. So the whole process of even getting exposed to all the different nominees, people submitting And then going down to, you know, here are the official nominations and listening to all the music, I learned a lot by doing that whole process.
So how many songs did you have to listen to?
Oh, God, a lot. So you have to vote in, I think it's 12 different categories, and there's 5 nominees. But prior to that, you know, there's a lot more people combined just to become a nominee. So you do the best you can to sit down and make space. You know, the actual voting at the last process, I took a whole week. And Dennis listened to all it. We listened to it together. So it was great because it's a way to just, you know, essentially learn more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have noticed that the last few years I've seen more independent artists get nominations, get the major nominations. I know we've had a couple that we play on KC Cafe Radio that have been nominated. So that was it's always a thrill to see people you know and people you've kind of played on the station be nominated. Because, I mean, you were all about the independent artist on KC Cafe Radio. So
yeah. And there's a ton of great music.
Yeah, there's so much good music. Lastly, I just want to ask you guys, tell me a little bit about what you guys have planned for your future.
Well, we just got back from the East Coast a little over a week ago, and we had done some performances in Florida and a performance in Connecticut. Kind of catching our breath. We are, as Laurie said earlier, she's feeling kind of stoked up to produce new songs and be working on those things. They've been mulling around in there for a while, and I think that they are ready to start coming out. Part of what we want to do is to start working towards creating enough material to be able to record our next album. We're hoping that, at least contemplating the idea, that we may try to go to do maybe a month-long tour or something like that in Germany or someplace in Europe this fall. We haven't arranged it yet. We're still... That would be a first for us. So, you know, there's a learning curve in terms of how you do all these types of things. We've had some video stuff that we've just done. So, you know, part of it, there's just...
We have to create another video.
It's really amazing that every step of the way, you know, there are all these new and different things that you're exposed to get up the learning curve. So, you know, trying to learn about creating a video, how do you edit a video, what do you, you know, the musical side of it, the video side of it, you know, just the various legalities of different types of things. We're going to be performing up, doing some performances up in Canada and trying to figure all that kind of stuff out. I thought that music would keep me interested, and you know, that I wouldn't run out of new and different things to learn. And boy, has that proven to be the case. Every, you know, in some ways, it's like there's so much to learn that it can be like, wait, I just want to go in studio or in my studio, and I want to go play music, you know, and find time to do that. But, you know, what's next for us is hopefully continuing to grow and develop as musicians, to continue to grow and develop as performers, to get the material together for a new album. Lori, what else is there that we have to do? She's the one who's organized. So what else do I have to do?
I'm more of a manager. The booking agent manager. I mean, honestly, it's a pleasure to be able to stay in Bellingham for the summer. We will probably make a trip down to Portland to play down there. But we're really, I mean, it's crazy that it sounds. We're excited to play outside. We got a bunch of outdoor gigs set up. And it's just such a nice time of year here in the Pacific Northwest that it's just wonderful to be outside. And then after that, yeah, Europe, and then we'll see. Yeah.
Well, great. Hopefully you can make it back across maybe to Missouri again and come to Folk Alliance again and do that.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's on the plans too.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll let everybody know how to get in touch with you guys. They have a website, is raviscole.com. It's RAVEISKOLE, Ravis Cole. You can find their music at CD Baby, iTunes, and Amazon. And you can also go to YouTube for videos, several videos that they've got out now. So it's been a great pleasure talking with Dennis Cole and Lori Ravis. Thank you guys once again.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you, Kathy.
And I just want to say it one more time, raviscole.com. Yeah. Is there anything else on the website that I'm missing that they should check out?
Lori has a mnemonic that she's dying to share.
Well, the easiest way to remember Ravis Cole is if you say the rave is Ravis Cole.
Ah, there you go.
Our artist friends came up with that, and it's just it's easier because the name is not spelled how you may think it should be spelled.
All right. But the rave is Cole, so. All right. Great. Thank you, Ravis Cole, Lori, and Dennis. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Kathy.